A word of caution. Whatever you're not willing to consider, you're protecting. Whatever you're protecting is more important to you than what you otherwise would have considered. If truth is something you are not willing to consider, then you have already decided to live a lie. Truth, however, has never been given to us for our consideration. It has always been given to us for our obedience. We must get to a place as Christians, as a church, we must get to a place where truth matters more to us than whatever else we have protected to date. There is nothing that comes from God that is true for us today that should cause you to be afraid. And yet it is almost impossible for us to talk about the things that we're going to over the next 5 weeks without people being afraid. Fear, refusal, rejection, and disobedience are all indications of a much deeper issue. And that issue is well known to us all, for it is the issue that befalls us all. For all of us have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Steve Corbett and Brian Fickert have written a book called When Helping Hurts. David Platt quotes it. He says, "The Bible's teachings should cut to the heart of North American Christians. By any measure, we are the richest people ever to walk on planet Earth. Furthermore, at no time in history has there ever been greater economic disparity in the world than at the present. The average American lives on more than $90 per day. But approximately 1 billion people live on less than $1 per day. 2.6 billion people, 40% of the world's population, live on less than $2 per day. What is the task of the church? We are to embody Jesus Christ by doing what he did and what he continues to do through us. That is, declare, using both words and deeds, that Jesus is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who is bringing a kingdom of righteousness, justice, and peace. And the church needs to do this where Jesus did it, among the blind, the lame, the sick and outcast, and the poor." David Platt quotes four statistics. He says there are approximately 153 million children living as orphans in the world today, meaning they have lost at least one parent. 18 million of that 153 million have lost both parents. Not included in that number, though, are millions of effectively orphaned children who live in institutions or on the streets. And in addition to the vast multitudes who live as social orphans, meaning that even if a parent is alive, the children rarely, if ever, see that parent or experience life as part of a family. These numbers are so vast that it is impossible to calculate, and there's no way to count street kids and those who are social orphans. The two issues that we are presented with in light of this is the issue of wealth. When we talk about orphans, we oftentimes are also talking about those who've been widowed or who are cut off from whatever means of support they previously have known. We talk about orphans, those with one parent or with no parents, those who are living without parental supervision or guidance, those who are destitute. When we talk about people who are poor, we're not talking about people who don't have enough money to pay for their cell phone bill and their cigarettes and their most recent alcohol purchase and their cable. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people who do not have enough money to buy the next meal with nothing else. There is a skewed understanding that comes from the pit of hell that has so deeply entwined itself into American culture that we now not only fail to understand what it means to be poor, but we also have become so disconnected from it that we don't even know how to begin finding our way back to helping. Wealth, widows, and orphans. That's your subject for the day. How do we deal with these different things? When you read in your book, you'll find that wealth is dealt with in one chapter, while widows and orphans are dealt with in another. But today I want us to focus our full attention on this message, focusing on wealth, widows, and orphans. There are two passages of scripture that you can jot down so that you'll have them later. I'm going to read them to you and we're going to use them, but there will be others to go along with them. We build this around three basic points, and it begins, first of all, with the subject of contentment. Listen to what is said in Job 1:21. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord." But listen to this, as it's repeated for us in the passage I listed for you. 1 Timothy 6:6 through 10 says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. For those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." You need to understand that when we talk about money, it is perhaps the most uncomfortable subject for us to discuss in this venue. And immediately people's defenses go up, and immediately you block out anything that may be coming because you've started to defend your wealth or perceived wealth. You believe that I'm coming for it. I want to remove all of that from you. I want to make sure that you understand that I am coming for it. I want you to make sure that you understand that God wants your money. And if you are not willing to surrender the wealth that He gave you to Him for His discretion, not your own, then you have already built up a wall of defense that effectively cuts you off from being useful in the kingdom of God, and you become nothing more than an observer without any in-depth transformative work of the Spirit taking place within you. If we cannot surrender all that we have, then what is it that you can surrender? If you cannot give what you have been blessed with that doesn't belong to us in the first place, for we are but stewards of that, then how is it that we hope to hang on to it? It has been said time and time again that there are no U-Hauls attached to a hearse. You cannot take it with you. Job made it clear that he brought nothing into this world. When he left, he took nothing with him. Jesus said, "Set your minds on things above, not the things of this earth." He calls us to a heavenly mindedness. It is an interesting thing for us to read through the New Testament, especially the Gospels, so that we see clearly the words of Jesus and discover there that Jesus said more about hell than he did heaven. He said more often, "Fear not," than any other single phrase. And he spoke more about money than any other single subject. That's an interesting thing. Because really, when you look at that and you see what Jesus did and what Jesus talked about and what Jesus taught the disciples, it's kind of the opposite of what we do. We never talk about money. We never talk about wealth. We rarely talk about hell, and we often sing of and talk about heaven. We have taken the cultural approach to only focusing attention on that which makes us feel better or enhances our comfort. Think about this in regard to the subject of wealth and what the Bible has to say about it. Do you realize that of evangelical Christians right now, in 2014, it is estimated, as best as anyone can ever come to a conclusion about this, it is estimated that evangelical Christians of all denominations across the board in the United States, that only 2.3% of those evangelical Christians, people who call themselves Christians and likely belong to a church, only 2.3% of them give anything to the church or to Christian causes. 2.3%? You say, well, you can't talk about money because then that makes you sound like a televangelist. Do I look like a televangelist? Don't answer that, please. I can take you being mad at me because I preach on money. I can't take you telling me I look like a televangelist. 2.3%. I don't know what the percentage is within the Southern Baptist Convention. I don't know what the percentage is in Temple Baptist Church. And quite frankly, I don't want to know. I'm afraid that it would negatively impact my understanding and make it harder for me to preach the kind of message that I need to preach. So I just didn't ask. I just know that this is a constant issue and it becomes a volatile matter. And I don't, for the life of me, understand why, except that we have made it personal and we have said this is off limits. When we build fences and keep God out, trouble comes quickly. In regard to wealth, the Bible has much to say. 1 Timothy is one of the most glaring passages that you can find. With godliness and contentment is great gain. Do we find contentment in being like God? Do we find contentment in the things of God? Do we find contentment and satisfaction and fulfillment and purpose and direction in that which we experience from God? The answer to that is very simply, no, we do not. If that were true, if we found contentment in our relationship with God to the degree that all of these other things were not so important, then this would not be a volatile issue. This would not be something that touches off so many conversations and exception clauses that are put in. But we have gotten to a point where this is simply not true of us. We do not find our fulfillment and satisfaction in our relationship with Christ, but we find it in that along with all of this other stuff. And we get worked up and we get angry and we get upset and we get defensive and we hold on to the wrong thing. In the process of holding on to things, we forget about godliness. We forget about the contentment that it brings. He reminds us of how foolish it is when he says we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of the world. Have you ever thought about the fact that all sin makes us stupid? Have you ever thought about that? And I don't mean that to be harsh or use the word as a slang. I mean it to be descriptive. All sin makes us stupid. And so when we sin in this area, we do so almost like we can somehow hold on to this stuff, or almost as if this stuff belongs to us. It doesn't. We're stewards of it. Nothing more. God is the owner. And yet we forget the very basic logic of reality that we brought nothing in, we take nothing out. He said if we have food and clothing, we should be content with those things. There shouldn't be any need for anything else. Everything else becomes luxury. He said, but those who desire to be rich find themselves falling into a temptation, a snare, into senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. We already know that instead of focusing our lives on godliness, we focus our lives on the acquiring of things or the amassing of wealth. He says that it's going to lead to a destructive lifestyle. We already know that. We see it over and over again. We understand how difficult it is, even in our own lives, for us to try to manage all of that stuff. And it is hard to serve God and serve money. Jesus said it's actually impossible. The desire to be rich then leads us to temptations. It leads us into a snare. It leads us into senseless, harmful desires that plunge us into ruin and destruction. You know, one of the reasons there is decline in the attendance of churches across America today, it is because of the availability of other things to do and the wealth to do them. It is because we have gotten to a point where we have enough that we can do what we want, and therefore we do what we want without consideration of what God wants. He says the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And it is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. I learned this lesson a long time ago. My first pastorate, we had moved to Texas to go to seminary and had lived there about 7 months. And were helping and teaching and playing piano and stuff for a church plant in South Arlington. And it was exciting. Church was growing rapidly, and it was fun to be part of it. And literally, we were there on the ground floor. It had just started. But I wanted to preach. God had called me to pastor. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to just teach a Sunday school class. I didn't want to sit on the sideline. I wanted to be where I felt God had called me to be. So I was looking for church. I got a call from a church, Mount Carmel Baptist Church, in Joshua, Texas. That's how they say it. I don't know why. And we went over there. I preached for them. They said that it was okay. And probably I should come back and do it again. I said, well, just to clarify, do you want me to preach the same sermon again, see if I can improve on it, or do you want me to do another one? No, you should do another one. So I came back the next week and I preached another one. Well, it was a little better, they thought. Maybe you ought to come back one more time. We'll see if you can actually get that. Went back the third time. I told them, this is it. You're going to need to make a decision. And I went back the third time. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and call you. It was almost like reluctantly, you know. We're helping you out. And they were. Honestly, they were helping me out. But it was a weird scenario. Got over there and started pastoring, and I preached on Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. We lived in Fort Worth. It was about 30 miles away. And went to school, worked for UPS. Kathy was working. Everything was just a crazy, crazy life. And so on Sunday afternoons, I'd make some visits and contacts, and I went to see a gentleman whose wife attended very faithfully. And I asked her, I said, so your husband, I understand he used to attend. He's a member here. I said, what happened? She said, well, he's just kind of fallen out with the church. I said, well, is it something I can help with? She said, no, I don't think so. I said, well, are you sure? Because I'm really good with people. She said, no, I think it'd be better if you just leave him alone. Well, I just couldn't do it. So I went to his house. I said, you know, your wife warned me not to come see you, and I don't know why. I said, what's going on? He said, I'll tell you. He said, I started a business here not long ago, and I realized that if I was going to make it in business, that I was going to change some of the things in my life. And so he said, I went to church, and I got saved. And I got baptized. And I started giving money because I'd been told that if you give, God will bless you. And so I started giving money and hoping that God would bless, and he didn't. And eventually my business went belly up, and I had to file bankruptcy, and I've been working for someone else just to try to get us out of our bankruptcy arrangements. And he said, quite frankly, he said, that whole business about faith and God and religion and saved and stuff doesn't work. You're all a bunch of liars. Now, I'm, you know, 22, 23 years old. I only thought I knew everything. I didn't really. And this was my first angry church member as a pastor. Everybody up to that point had been like having a church full of grandparents. That's what it had been like for me. And so they treated me, you know, they patted me on the head, they pulled on my cheek, they told me they loved me and they were sweet about it and all this stuff. And they brought me pies and cakes and stuff and vegetables out of the garden and pieces of meat off of the latest slaughtered whatever. And it was cool, but not this guy. This guy was mad. And I had just become the object of his anger. And I said, I'm really sorry. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to take him from his flawed theological position to a place where he could understand this from an appropriate perspective. I mean, he started off wrong, and now everything was messed up. Listen to what this says. It says, threw this into a snare, senseless, harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. In this way, through this craving, some have wandered from the faith and have pierced themselves. Pierced themselves with many pangs. That's where he was. That's where he was. I needed to go back and help him to understand salvation from an appropriate biblical perspective and faith matter. It wasn't something he did, it's something God did. He went and got saved, that's what he did. And he got baptized, that's what he did, in order to become a member of the church and start giving money and getting blessed along the way. That was all him. None of that was God. It doesn't work like that. It's never worked like that. And when you start with the wrong relational foundation, everything is jacked up from then on. And that's what happened to him. Folks, I believe that we are living in a culture where people have such a glib and shallow understanding of the call that God has placed on our lives that we never once consider that being a Christian and belonging to Jesus Christ involves every aspect, every area of our experience. Otherwise, have you come to the place where you realize that your salvation is only incomplete and it only saves the little pieces and parts of you that are good? That's not how Jesus died. Died for us, and that's not how Jesus called us. If it does not involve this, then it's because we've made this more important than God, and we no longer are content with what we find in Him. This is a constant struggle, and anybody who says it isn't probably really hasn't engaged the issue. But I know it is for me. Contentment. Contentment is the foundation. How does that relate to orphans and widows? One of the greatest ministries that we have with orphan care involves money. It involves support. The cost of adopting, the cost of fostering, the cost of setting aside time in your life, of changing your household in some way in order to accommodate children who have no families or parents, the cost that is associated with the adoption process, whether here or overseas, is staggering. It's in many cases, it's a car or it's a house. It's a large amount of money. Anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000 is involved in trying to adopt a child in order to give them a home and a better life and to give them hope. When it comes to widows, many of the folks who find themselves widowed in life because of the death of a spouse also find that they have planned for that and prepared for that financially, or they have family members who continue their support. But there are widows across this world who are living today with no means of support other than begging or stealing. Hundreds of thousands of families devastated by war, oppression, and disease. We talk about orphans, we're talking about children and children's ministry, and it's one of the most difficult things to do, especially in light of these kinds of circumstances. And the question is, are we content? Are we satisfied with who we are? Or are we content in who God has called us to be? It is impossible for us to understand contentment when it comes to what God has provided us for and not then get all judgy about how we dole it out. Well, I'm willing to give, but you're going to have to do it this way. I'm willing to give, but you're going to have to do it this way. I'm willing to give, but you're going to have to do it this way. Are you sure those people are worthy of my money? I'm sure they're not. Just as I'm sure you're not worthy to have it in the first place. If it was based on worth or worthiness, none of us would have anything. I don't know how we get past this, but I do know that this is the key. Contentment comes as a result of our satisfaction in Christ and in our settled confidence in who God is. Contentment remains as long as we continue to be fixed on Him. But when we turn away from Him, we find ourselves being drawn away into things that have more to do with our culture and less to do with our God. Not only does He call us to contentment, but He calls us by virtue of a commandment. Listen to what is said in Mark 12, 30 through 31. You've already heard it many times. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. In light of that commandment, listen to what James 1:27 says. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Pure, undefiled faith. The commandment is to love God and then in turn to love others. The Good Samaritan set the example for us in that he not only loved enough to help in a time of need, but he did so at great personal expense. He did so in a way that defined for us what real helping ministry is supposed to look like. Jesus used this Samaritan man as an example of what the sort of godly compassion that we should have toward one another is always going to be like. If we cannot extend that compassion to each other, then we have no hope of reaching beyond our own boundaries and limits to those who are in need of fostering and those who are in need of adopting, those who are in need of help and support in that ministry. The commandment that God gives us is very clear that we love Him, but if we love Him, that we will in turn love others as well. He says that this is the greatest, most important. Today, the opportunities are so vast for us to be involved in this subject. We can support orphan care through the work that we are doing. We gave $2,500 to the orphanage in Guatemala this past summer. $2,500. You say, well, that's pretty good. It is pretty good, and it makes us one of the largest contributors. In addition to that, almost all of the people who have made Guatemala trips, almost all of them have in turn sponsored a child and are currently doing it, some of them more than one. Mark and Anna had sponsored a child from their very first trip down there. They even flew down there in May to be there for this special event, kind of like a graduation thing that they go through, so that they could be there as the kind of quasi-adoptive parents. You say, well, I can't do that. You can sometimes, if you plan properly, you can fly to Guatemala and you can be at Santa Cruz for $400. You can sponsor a child for $30 a month. I went to McDonald's the other day and took my grandchildren and my wife, because I don't take my grandchildren without my wife. Because they scare me. $32. Happy meals and salads. And my grandchildren aren't even allowed to drink soda. So $30. One trip to McDonald's to get food that is horrible for you. $30 to sponsor a child in an orphanage at Casa Day. $30 will sponsor a child, in fact, in just about any orphanage in the world. $30 will feed a child for almost 6 months in many places in the world. $30 can do more to help one child than you can possibly imagine. Do you have an extra $30? Well, I don't know. How many trips to McDonald's did you make? The commandment is that we love God. We will never learn to love others. We will never care for the homeless. We will never care for the broken. We will never care for the widow and the orphan until we care more about the heart of God than we do our own junk. The commandment is not designed to make us love others. The commandment is a call to love God. Loving others is an automatic response to loving God. So that if the problem is a lack of love for others, the problem really is a lack of love for God. Out of that flows a commitment. Our contentment with the things that God has given us enables us to be obedient to the commandment to love Him above everything else, so that we start to realize that He didn't call us to give some of our things. He called us to give everything, so that He would say things like, take up your cross and follow me, but only after He has said, deny yourself. It flows into a commitment. Listen to what it says in 1 John 3:17. This is a good one to note. I should have included it in the first list. If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, then how does God's love abide in him? Very simply, it doesn't. David Platt offers in the study guide five things that we can do in response that show a commitment. He says, first of all, we need to work diligently. Is it bad to work for money? It isn't. In fact, it would be the opposite. Bad would be not working. The reason that we work is in order to get enough to support ourselves, our families, and to sustain ourselves. But then we work diligently so that we have more, not so that we spend it on ourselves, but that we have more to give. We need to understand that working diligently is a biblical command, and not working is laziness, which is a biblical prohibition. But it's not my job to worry about the people who aren't working hard enough. It's my job to work hard myself. He says, work diligently. And then he says, live simply. How could you simplify your life? And what is it that you could carve out of the things that you currently spend money on, or the things that you currently do that are costing you beyond what you should? Are there things that you could do to simplify your life that would increase the amount of money, not that you have, but the amount of money that you give away? Give sacrificially. Most of us have no concept of what this means. Jesus taught us about giving sacrificially when he used the illustration of the widow who came in with a single coin. It was all that she had in the world. She had no other resources or financial means, and she gave everything that she had. The rich man came in and he gave 1,000 times more than she did, and yet it wasn't even a dent in his excess. Jesus said the one who's given the most and who's given out of faith is the widow who gave it all. Sacrificial giving means that we give up something that we currently have in order to have enough to give to something else. If we are only giving out of what is left over, it isn't sacrificial. Christians no longer tithe because we don't think that that's important. Or people say to me, well, the Bible doesn't mention it in the New Testament, and it doesn't say anything about tithing. That's right, it doesn't. Tithing is an Old Testament concept. 10% of what you earn is supposed to go to God. But then when we get to the New Testament, what happens? We give above and beyond. We give out of poverty. We give sacrificially. We give everything. Let me tell you something. 10% is a discount. Very few people tithe. People tell me all the time, well, I just can't. Go back to the first part. Work diligently. Look at the second part. What can you simplify? Start working toward being obedient. Giving sacrificially then means not only tithe. The tithe is just where we begin. Giving the tithe is what we do to sustain the work and ministry of the church. And then God calls us to do other things above and beyond that, so that we give sacrificially out of the resources that God has given us. help constructively. It's not enough for us just to give. If we're going to help widows and orphans, it means getting involved in their lives. One of the things that I detest and love at the same time is our MRT program here. MRT stands for Ministry Resource Team. It used to mean a larger thing than it does now. Now what it means is financial support for people in the community who need it. And every week people come and we give them financial support. It's either food or it's money toward the cost of electric or gas, utility bills, or sometimes a few other things, but we have a pretty restrictive list. You have to fill out paperwork. You have to be a person that's only received help one time. We don't give it multiple times. And on and on and on this list goes. People come in, we give them help, and they go out. We give them a tract, we give them a Bible, but we don't do anything else. That's it. We just get them out. Do you realize that Marilyn and Mary Ann spend as much time dealing with MRT requests as they do anything to do with this church? And if you catch it on the week that they're turning off the electric or the utilities, it'll go up exponentially. They can't build relationships with people, and even if they could, that's not their job. That's the job of the church. What do we do with MRT? I don't know, but I know what we're doing now isn't working. We're not really helping. In fact, most of the people that are receiving assistance from us, from the money that you give, most of those people are going to squander it, and they are not going to do anything else to change the order of their life. That, again, isn't my responsibility, but it is my responsibility to look at the problem and say, can we do better? I believe we can, and I believe we should. But the only way that happens is if you and I get together and we decide on a way to help people so that we start getting involved. Instead of you coming in and getting a check or a payment or a food voucher, you come in and get to know a person. What if we set aside a day of the week and that was MRT day and anybody wanting assistance could come? And what if you volunteered to be a counselor or to help people or to pray with them or to find out what other needs were going on in their life or to share the gospel with them or to help them in some other way? What if we did that? That's what he means when he speaks of helping constructively. It isn't just about giving people what they physically need. It's also about giving them what they spiritually need, and that only happens through relationships. And then we must invest eternally. Understand that what we do in the name of Christ is something that cannot be undone. It cannot be taken back, and it cannot be removed from us. Finding contentment in that which God has given you. Listening and obeying the commandment to love God as well as others, and committing your life to work diligently, live simply, give sacrificially, help constructively, and invest eternally. These are things that we can all do. Something that maybe helps to put it into perspective: renew your relationship with God by confessing your sin and surrendering to His will and His word. I suggest to you that all of the other things that I have told you about will never happen until this one does. If sin is blocking you or keeping you, whatever that sin may be, you will make no forward progress in kingdom purpose. Resolve, after you have renewed your relationship with God, resolve to get involved by adjusting your life in whatever way is necessary to take that first step of obedience. I realize that it may take some time. Not everybody's going to look the same, and not all giving is going to be the same. That's not the point of this. The point is obedience. Refuse to yield to doubt or fear or the lies that are part of the common practice of our culture. Refuse to go with the flow or to believe that what you have always thought you knew was right. Consider for a moment the possibility that God is right and these things are not. And then rejoice in the riches that are found only in God. If you do not have joy in knowing Jesus Christ, if you do not have joy in living a surrendered life in service, if you do not find joy in humility, then you're never going to be able to grasp and understand what He is calling us to. Jesus said these words: take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. One's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. He told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have nowhere to store my crops. He said, I will do this. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store my grain and my goods. And then I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself, but is not rich toward God. Rejoice in the riches of God. It'll make everything else seem the way it should. It'll put all of life into perspective. How we handle wealth is going to, in turn, affect how we love God. How we love God is going to change how we love others. We will never minister to even the most obvious that are in need, orphans and widows, if we are unable to get past this other stuff. They don't need just your handout. They need to hold your hand. It's different. One is cultural religion. The other is true and genuine faith. All that's left is obedience.